Hello, good afternoon. Hi, my name is Lisa Falsco. I'm the CEO of the Alaska World Affairs Council, and it's such a pleasure to see everyone here today. And it's exciting for me to have a panel on lessons we can learn from Norway. So I thought I'd start with my welcome. You're used to me being up here and giving a bunch of administrative details, so I thought the first detail and lesson we could learn from Norway was Norwegian. So I'm going to give it in Norwegian. Vi har en god brødbasket I dag fra Great Harvest, og det koster bare $2. Og du kan ha en sjanse å vinne dette brød. Bare kom til Kari på front table, og så skal du få Great Harvest brød. So, if anybody got that, you are now Norwegian. You've learned something. If you could please take a moment to turn off your cell phones. This program is being recorded on KSKA and KACN-TV. So for our listeners, please turn off your cell phone. And I'd like to thank William Toyer for doing the recording today for KSKA and Katie Parrish for KACN. If this is your first Alaska World Affairs Council program, if you could please raise your hand. Do we have any people? This is their very first. Oh, great. Super. Thank you so much for coming. And if you like this program, you might be interested in our program next week, where we will be down in the ballroom with Larry Persley, who will be talking about Alaska natural gas. Does any country need that? If you are a student, if you could please stand and be recognized. Do we have any students here, even though school's not in session for college? Oh, yes. Look at that. Super. Thank you very much for coming. And thank you, BP, for sponsoring the student lunches. And I saw in that group of students standing up two people I'd like to mention. The World Affairs Council, if you're not familiar, is part of the Anchorage School Business Partnership. And we support the Gifted High School Mentorship Program. And in our audience for the last time is Kale Klingenpeel from South High School, who's been with us all semester. Hi, Kale, in the back, who did a great job with us. And we have a new student. She wasn't able to make it here, but she will be with us next week. And her name is, it's not on here, Sarah. She'll be here next week. And I also see a student who has returned on Christmas break. Now, our high school gifted interns go on to do amazing things in the world. And Callie Smith is a graduate of Polaris High School. She went to, or still going to, Lewis and Clark, but doing studies all over. She's been in Kenya and Tanzania, and she's here on break and then going off to Cuba. So, Callie Smith, welcome back, and thank you. And speaking of students, I'd like to quickly bring up Brian Davies, who is going to talk about WorldQuest, the high school competition for students with their chance to go to Washington, D.C. Brian.
Thank you, Lisa. Well, this year is the seventh of our academic WorldQuest regional competitions. As many of you know, WorldQuest is a quiz based upon current and foreign affairs. And we invite high schools to send teams to this competition, which will be held on February the 4th over at UAA. And the winner of this competition goes to Washington to compete with teams from across the country for the National WorldQuest Championship Award. In the past, Wasilla has been the standout performer here. I think that we've sent a Wasilla team to Washington three times, and they've done very, very well. So the competition is very generously sponsored once again by ConocoPhillips, but we do need to raise funds to send the team to Washington. Not an inexpensive proposition, as you probably all know. So we would like you to consider supporting by sponsoring a team or sponsoring part of a team. The full sponsorship for a full team is $300, but you may sponsor teams of four, so you may sponsor a quarter of a team, half a team, three quarters of a team, or the full team at $300. There are pledge slips on your table. and hope somebody will find them there. And during the course of the presentation, you may give a little thought to this, and if you'd like to sponsor it, please fill those out and give them to Carrie at the table as you leave. Thank you very much in advance for your support. It's a very well worthwhile cause. Alaska is always very well represented, and I look forward to your support. Thank you.
Thanks, Brian. And at the table, there's also some books, Great Decisions by Foreign Policy Association, that the students are reading and competing on. And if you want to pick up a copy and read up yourself, we have some extra ones. And we also have a book of our speaker coming in February, Trita Parsi, that's actually not out on the bookshelves yet. It's called A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. You can pick that up at the head table as well. And now I'd like to introduce Ira Perman, who will be the moderator of today's panel. Ira Perman is the board chair of the Institute of the North, a public policy research institute founded by Governor Wally Hickel. Among the institute's focuses are Alaska's energy development needs and advocating Alaska's role as a resource owner state. Perman was director of the Alaska Humanities Forum, another organization with a public policy focus. For 20 years prior, he was the director of the Anchorage Concert Association. He and 44 other Alaskans traveled to Norway in August to learn how Norway's success attracts investment capital to develop its oil and gas resources. What they found was a prosperous country and a country that owns and aggressively attracts enormous investment capital for the benefits of its citizens and oil and gas industry. Perman and his wife, Virginia, have lived in Anchorage since the construction of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline and have raised two daughters here. Ira.
Thank you very much, Lisa. I want to thank you for inviting the Institute of the North to do this presentation today, and thank you to your board of directors as well. It's a great crowd we have here. Delighted to see the tremendous interest in this program. As Lisa said, I am the chair of the board of the Institute of the North. I'd like to point out our executive director, Nils Andresen, and Abigail Inghurst, our staff. Would you please stand and take a quick bow for them? The Institute of the North, indeed, is a research and public policy institute. Our turf is, see here in a minute, the North. If you come to our office, you will see a lot of maps like this. This is our favorite view of the world. And in fact, when we are over in Norway, Norway looks at the world like this too. Everywhere you went, you had this sort of different perspective. And it's a very important perspective to have, and particularly as the world moves ahead. Today, we're very fortunate to have three of the members who went on the tour with us this late summer. And I'll introduce them in the order from, my left, your right, to the other end of the table, starting with Ella Eade. Ella Eade is the Stakeholder Engagement Manager for Statoil Alaska, responsible for community relations and communication. She's a lifelong Alaskan. She has over 22 years of experience working in the oil and gas and mining industries. She was raised in rural Alaska Native villages, including Koyukuk, Kaniganek, Naknik, Nikolai, and Selowik. How'd I do in the pronunciation there? Good. Oh, thank you. Her experience includes environmental management, stakeholder engagement, and public relations. She is currently on the board of directors of the Resource Development Council and Alaska Resource Education, whose mission is to educate students about Alaska's natural resources. Ella's primary focus at Statoil is on establishing the company's corporate social responsibility policy for Alaska, which includes an emphasis on educational initiatives and community investment. Alongside Ella is Rebecca Logan. Rebecca has a long resume of leadership in Anchorage community. She's presently the general manager of the Alaska Industry Support Alliance. Prior to working for the Alliance, she served as president of the Associated Builders and Contractors of Alaska. She's also owned and operated restaurants in Anchorage area for 10 years. She served on two terms on the Chugach Electric Association Board of Directors, including Stu Stentz as their chair of the board. She chaired also the Joint Rail Utility Task Force that created the New Generation and Transmission Co-op that includes 5 of the 6 Rail Belt utilities. She is currently a member of the Special Olympics Alaska Board, will be its chair this year, and is the mother of 2 beautiful daughters, Lindsay and Lauren. At the end of the table, we have Brad Keithley. Brad is a partner and co-head of the oil and gas practice at Perkins Coie. He is based in the firm's Anchorage and Washington, D.C. offices. Prior to joining Perkins Coie, Brad was a partner for 18 years with the global law firm of Jones Day, based primarily in the firm's Dallas and Houston offices. Throughout his career, Brad's practice has been concentrated in the areas of oil and gas regulation, commercial transactions, and litigation. I give you your head table. Before I ask Ella to come up, I'm going to do a little bit of an introduction to Norway, and I'm sure you know where it is on this map. And first, here's why we went. 45 of us, which included 12 legislators, both Republicans and Democrats, all of us are very concerned about Alaska's economic future. And this graph is sort of a shorthand. I think just about everybody in this room knows this is the production history and projection of oil down the TAPS line. We're all concerned about it falling off here at the end, and we thought we might learn something from Norway as to what they do about their oil. There's a lot of similarities in our two worlds. And so we went over there to research what Norway is doing to prevent that from happening. We'll talk lots about that today. First, a little orientation. Norway, to the right of that map of Norway would be Sweden, the Atlantic out to the left. I've included on here a couple of Anchorage cities to show you the relative latitudes. Anchorage is just a little bit north of Oslo. Fairbanks and Trondheim are similar. And Barrow is about the same as the top of Norway where we went, and you'll hear more about the Hammerfest LNG facility. On July 22nd, 5 weeks before we went, Norway was hit by a terrible, terrible act of internal terrorism. I'd call him a deranged individual, went and took a truck bomb and blew up a lot of the government buildings, set up a bomb in front of all the government buildings. This was a building we were to have had many of our meetings in. He then went and did something even far worse. He went out 20 miles to the north and shot and killed about 70 young people at a camp. It was a horrible, horrible incident for Norway. When we got there at the end of August, Norwegians were quietly grieving. This is a picture of a square just about a block and a half from our hotel. Those are all flowers in that square. Norwegians, they poured their grief out, poured their hearts out, and the world rallied behind them. Loads of messages from dignitaries from around the world. And when we got there, it was my sense that the Norwegians were very happy that we were there. They were very pleased to see us. It was sort of an affirming thing. They went way out of their way to make this tour happen. They rescheduled meetings all across town, prepared special presentations to us, and it truly was a remarkable experience, and we were fortunate to have been there at that very special time. This is a picture I took of downtown. In the foreground, the white building is their famous new opera building that opened up about 3 years ago. It's just the boring corner of that building, but what really struck me was the background. Look at that construction scene. I've never seen so many construction cranes in my life as I saw in downtown Oslo. If I swung the camera to the left, to the right, it would have been the same. Just a construction boom. You have a very, very prosperous, aggressive, and that's, by the way, that's private sector construction happening there. They believe in the future of that country. Some statistical snapshots of the country. The population, not quite 5 million people, very similar to, say, one state of ours, Minnesota. As they say, half the Norwegians live in Norway, the other half in Minnesota. But I know, by the way, how many of you are Norwegians or married to Norwegians or have Norwegians in your family? Quite a few. That's what we've discovered. Okay. Norrie's population is about 7 times that of Anchorage. Just keep that in the back of your mind. Tried to get a sense of their relative prosperity on a per capita basis, and you can see per capita, they far exceed us, but things are expensive over there and taxes are high over there. Tried to get a better sense, and that next thing is called PPP. That means purchasing power parity after taxes. They're higher than the U.S. average and probably just, I'm guessing, a little higher than the Alaska average. I couldn't get a figure on that. We did discover that things are very expensive. The first night we went out, we all had to pay for our liquor bill. I want to tell you, this was the most... The beers were $18 a beer. This was the most sober working group I've ever traveled with. We just... Very expensive. Their unemployment rate is about the world's lowest right now, 3%. They have to import some of their labor. A figure we're all familiar with here in Alaska, the percentage of government annual expenditure paid by oil and gas. Over there, it ranges from 10 to 26%. Of course, in Alaska, it ranges 80 to 90%. Just so you know, it is a democratically elected unicameral parliament, and it has a king. They love their king. We went to the parliament, and the tour director there said, everybody in Norway is welcome to come to this parliament chambers except for one person. That would be the king. The king is by law forbidden to get involved in the making of laws over there. They love their king. What does that tell you? Here's one more, one of my two favorite statistics or pieces of information about Norway. This is their permanent fund compared to our permanent fund. This is what caught everybody's attention, and this is why all the legislators went. They, oh my gosh, $570 billion compared to our $40 billion permanent fund. And if you look at the fine print, I don't know if you can see it, Norway's been working at it only half as long as we have and has used less oil to get there. And so everybody went, what's that all about? And so this is a big mystery that sent us. And by the way, the bottom line, if you can see it down here low, they anticipate their permanent fund will be $3 trillion before they run out of oil and gas. That's really permanent. For the purposes of our presentation, I want to give you a little geographic orientation to their oil resources. Their oil resources are all outer continental shelf. The North Sea at the bottom, the Norwegian Sea in the middle, and the Barents Sea at the top, that's all outer continental shelf. That means it's all publicly owned. That in some ways makes it parallel to the publicly owned North Slope oil that is on Alaska's state land. Bear that in mind. It's different than, say, the Kenai, but this is quite comparable in some ways to our onshore oil and gas. Finally, one of my last slides here. This is Norway's production curve. It does look different. It doesn't go up as steeply when it ramped up more slowly. Peaked a little later than ours, and you can see it, while it has fallen, it hasn't fallen as far. And if you look at the far right-hand side, you'll notice that it seems to be leveling out. And in fact, what they told us is that they have stopped the decline of their oil and gas. They're managing to keep that level up about 3 times as high as we are and anticipate that they can continue to do that for the next 10 to 20 years, meaning they're getting the benefit of high volume and high prices. At this point, I'm going to turn the microphone and the podium over to Ella. Come on up, Ella, who's going to talk to us about Norway's oil company, Statoil.
All right. I'm a little shorter than Ira. Good afternoon. I started working for Statoil in July of last year, and I got wind of this great tour the Institute was putting on and thought, gee, it's probably a good idea to tag along and learn about Statoil, the company I'm working for, as well as Norway. So Ira only gave us about 6 or 7 minutes, so I'll be pretty brief, but we want to leave lots of time for questions. So essentially, the origin of Statoil, it was started by the Norwegian government in 1972 with an emphasis on learning about the oil industry, but as well as a way to provide jobs to Norwegians. And Statoil is currently a publicly owned company, but the government of Norway owns 67%. So essentially, I work for the government of Norway, right, Laura? but it also would be important to note that Statoil, just Statoil alone, earns dividends of $3 billion a year for the government of Norway. So quite a successful company. And over a quick overview of the company, Statoil is currently operating in 36 countries around the world. And with over 40 years of oil and gas experience, we are the third largest seller of crude oil and the world's largest offshore operator. The company has an excellent health, safety, and environmental record, and especially experience working in Arctic environments. So we are very happy to be in Alaska. We also learned on the trip that there are about 140 Norwegian oil and gas support companies, and that Norway's number two export is, in fact, that support expertise. We spent about most of a day in Statoil's office in Stavanger, which I don't know that we pointed that out. I think it's, let's see if I have a pointer here. It's right about here. But we also, on a different day, a group of us, about half the tour, traveled to northern Norway to Hammerfest, which is about the same latitude as Barrow. And we went there to visit the Statoil Snøhvit LNG facility, which is the first LNG facility built in the Arctic. And this facility is a lot of subsea infrastructure, but the main onshore facilities are based on this island, Melkøya Island, which is connected to the mainland through an undersea tunnel. That was pretty interesting to get there by bus in that tunnel. A little weird to drive under the ocean. But we had a great presentation by the head of the plant as well as the mayor of Hammerfest. And one of the things we learned from the mayor was that prior to Statoil making this discovery and developing Snøhvit, the population, as you can see on that graph, was declining quite significantly. And a lot of people were moving away. There weren't jobs. And as Snøhvit was developed, people actually moved back. And the economy there is booming. The local community of Hammerfest has gained a lot and is a participant in revenue sharing. So there's a lot of infrastructure benefits that have resulted from building this facility in Hammerfest, and just a really good example of a successful development in the Arctic. And this is a summer picture because we were there kind of in the summer, but winter pictures, this is as white as Barrow. As far as Statoil in Alaska, Statoil purchased 16 leases in the Chukchi Sea in 2008, and we are also a 25% partner in 50 leases operated by ConocoPhillips in the Devil's Paw prospect. We have our office open here in Anchorage since June of last year, and we're currently in the process of making the decision whether or not to apply for drilling permits, and once that decision is made early this year, our plan would be to optimistically drill in the open water season of 2014. One of the things that I wanted to point out that I found especially interesting while we were in Norway was there was a lot of focus during the trip on the tax structure in Norway, the investment structure, and this, of course, the success of oil and gas in Norway. But one thing that struck me in particular was the difference in the timeline it takes to permit exploration. And if you look at the top, you'll see that in Norway, it's approximately 8 months to gain your permits for exploration. 8 months. The Gulf of Mexico in the U.S. is about 14 months. And in Alaska, it's 32 months. And that's not counting legal challenges. So I think that we can't ignore the fact that part of the success in Norway is that stable regulatory environment that is very attractive to operators because they understand that there's a predictable process and they can succeed in a defined timeline, and that's important. So with that, thank you very much, and we are always happy to talk to people about Statoil. If anyone has interest, don't hesitate to contact me. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's good to see so many people here. I think this is the fourth time that I've spoken about the Norway trip, and we went in August, and every time the room is packed, so obviously it's of great interest. And I don't want to be a Debbie Downer, but since Ira had to put up the slide about their fund and how large it is, we do have to share with you, I don't know if Brad is going to talk about this, that there's a significant difference on why their fund is so much larger than ours, and that would be because they put every single penny of their oil revenues into that fund, every single penny. So we could be there if we did that. I don't know what else we'd have, but we could be there. So anyway, as Ira mentioned, I'm the general manager of the Alaska Support Industry Alliance. We're a 501c6 trade association that represents the support industry here in Alaska, the companies that support the oil, gas, and mining industries. We have about 460 members, and they employ about 35,000 people in the state of Alaska whose companies support those industries. And that's a little bit more than 10% of the workforce. So my interest in going and my board's interest in having me go is just to actually answer that question also, you know, can we learn? We hear so much about Norway and their successes, so can we learn from what they're doing? And obviously the answer to that question is yes, but the better question is, can we apply anything that we've learned from there to what we're doing here? So it was a fun trip, and as Ira mentioned, we were quite sober, not because we wanted to, but it was just the free market at work. It was $22 for my favorite kind of wine in the bar at the hotel. So it was probably okay that we were like that, because every morning the first thing that you smelled when you came to the breakfast buffet was pickled herring, and I don't know how that well that would have mixed with people having had lots of alcohol the night before. Anyway, so what did I learn? There are a couple things that really stuck out. Obviously, I represent companies who are in the support industry here. Norway has a thriving support industry over there. They have about 250,000 people who work in the oil and gas industry there. And so obviously they have a thriving support industry there, but not only do they have a thriving support industry there, they export that. They have a North American headquarters in Houston, and they have 140 Norwegian companies that are support companies that have offices in Houston. 140, that's huge. And Norway's number two export is oil and gas support expertise. We spent one day with a company who talked about all they do around the world to help third world countries who are starting to develop their resources, and they export their supply industry expertise. There are three things that really, really hit home for me while we were there, the three elements of what I learned there. And the number one message I think that I took from there is that there are elements of Norway's system that we cannot mimic. And Ella just referred to this a little bit, but the number one example there is their expedited permitting and review process. Everywhere we went, especially at Snøhvit, I think we were all just amazed at how quickly they got to production. And that's something that, you know, we aren't going to mimic that because of all the jurisdictions involved in everything that we do. We've got the feds, we've got our state, and we've got local government. And we have people, you know, we have outside groups who can come in and litigate after permits have been issued. And so we won't ever do what Norway does in that area. Okay, so that's very important to remember. The other piece that really hit home for me, and Brad is going to talk about this more, so I don't want to talk about it too much, but the idea of state investment as a working interest partner in new projects is a good idea. It could work here, and I think Brad is really going to talk about that. You know, alignment of interest, and I'll leave it at that because I know Brad's slides are on that. And then the final thing, I would be remiss if I didn't point out that Norway's marginal tax rate is lower than Alaska's at high oil prices. So at high oil prices like we're experiencing now, Norway's marginal tax rate all in is 78%. Ours is about 85% because it includes federal and state taxes and royalty. And in addition, Norway's rate of taxation does not increase with oil price, and ours does. So a simple fix to Alaska's tax system could actually make Alaska more attractive for investment than Norway, a very simple fix. So their taxes are actually lower than ours. And with that, I'll sit down.
I'm Brad Keithley. I'm the lawyer in the group, so whatever you think of lawyers, if you want to, those of you who want to listen now, or those of you who want to turn off. I want to start with one of the slides that Ira had. Go back more? There you go. No, I want to start with this one. I want to start with this slide, because this was really the focus of my participation in the trip. As Ira pointed out, the top line, the green line, is Norwegian production The bottom line is the purple or blue is Alaskan production. And when you look at investment, the difference in investment that's going on in Norway is about the same, between Norway and Alaska is about the same as that difference in production. There's a very close correlation between investment and production. And the level of investment that's going on in terms of oil and gas development in Norway is about as higher than Alaska as what you're seeing there in production as well. And the purpose of my participation was to try to figure out what's driving that increased investment in Norway and what's driving the increased production. Because Alaska has the resources, the oil and gas resources, known oil and gas resources, to be on that higher curve. But what's happened is, as a result of reductions in investment and reductions in activity, we've fallen down in terms of our production line, down to the lower curve. So my goal was to try to figure out what's driving that. Sort of get to see the rest of the slides as we... Yep, back up. Back. Oh, I see, it's in dark. Yeah, okay. So the biggest impact that I saw in Norway in terms of driving investment, which in turn drove production, is in fact that the biggest investor in Norway's oil and gas development is Norway, is the government of Norway. When Dan Sullivan, Commissioner Dan Sullivan, talks about what it is we need to get back, to get production back up to 1 million barrels a day, to move our production curve back up, he talks about investment, and he talks about the investment levels that are required to do that, and he talks about investment levels of between $4 and $5 billion a year in oil and gas development. What we're currently running, depending upon how you take into account maintenance expenditures, we're currently running somewhere in the neighborhood of $1.5 to $2 billion a year. We're shortfalling investment by roughly half of what we need to do in terms of getting production up. And Norway has in part solved this problem by investing in itself. They've taken money that is the result of their oil and gas activities. They've created a company called Petoro. The first company they created was Statoil, and Statoil was so successful that it went international and went private. So they've created a second company to focus specifically on Norway, Petoro. And through Petoro, which is 100% owned by the government, they invest as a co-working interest owner in the development of the oil and gas resources of the state. They have enough investment to cover all of the good investment opportunities that they have. Petoro owns about 20% of the working interest in all of the oil and gas fields as a co-working interest owner. Now, what's the significance of it being a co-working interest owner, of it having an investment stake in the development of the oil and gas reserves? Well, it aligns the state's economic interest with industry and makes the state part of the decision-making process. In Alaska, the way the state tries to run the oil and gas industry is sort of as a backseat driver. We don't invest any of our money in oil and gas. We rely on industry to make all the investment. But we sit in the back seat, and through regulation and through things like the Point Thompson lease termination proceedings, we try to tell industry what to do. We say, we want you to invest over here. Well, industry's reaction is, that's not a good investment. We don't want to invest over there. And if you're going to tell us to invest over there and we can't invest someplace else, we're going to go someplace else. In Norway, the government invests through Petoro alongside industry, invests its own money, and so it's in the room facing the same economic situation that the companies are, seeing the same economic returns, seeing the same economic limitations as the companies are, and it aligns the state's interest to go in the same direction as industry because they see the opportunity for returns in the same way. And it affects the government's view of industry. They're not trying to be backseat drivers telling the industry what to do. They're looking at the same economics as industry, and so they're inclined. The economic returns are speaking to them, and they're focusing on the same type of opportunities that industry is focusing on. What does that do in response? Well, it creates more investment in Norway on the private side, as well as on the public side. It grows the pie rather than what we do in Alaska, which is fight about which share everybody gets of the existing pie. It grows the pie because there's more industry investment that's made as a result of being aligned with government as opposed to fighting government. It brings, as I said, it brings a unified focus to expanding the pie rather than fighting over shares of a dwindling pie as we're doing in Alaska. And it avoids distorting producer decisions by requiring the investment of dead capital. Now, I'm sure you all realize this, but it's important to point out that in Alaska, we require companies to invest 100% of the investment, and they only get 85% of the return. The other 15% is the royalty share that goes to the state. The companies have to invest the 100% to get 85%. And if you don't think that distorts investments, then you haven't been around making investments a lot. That is, you've got to put in $100 and you only get a return on 85% of that back. In Norway, there isn't a royalty. The state earns its return, the huge returns that Ira showed in terms of the permanent fund that they have. They earn that by investing the state's own capital alongside industry, and it avoids distorting producer decisions by requiring, on the Alaska side, avoids the problem of requiring investment of dead capital. Norway had a leasing system that is very close to ours in the early stages of its enterprise. And we asked on several occasions why it is you gave up the leasing, why you gave it up the leasing approach that we use in Alaska. And they said, well, they quickly figured out it distorted investments and money was going overseas instead of coming to Norway. And so we wanted to bring money into Norway, so we stopped that system and we came over to the co-investment system, which we have found to be very successful since. They said, now we can understand, you know, when we advise new governments, for example, they're advising the government of Ghana now, when we advise new governments on the systems that they need to put in place, we don't discourage leasing as an initial part, as an initial approach, because we understand that governments need capital, need cash up front. Just like we needed in the late 1960s, we needed a cash infusion. My favorite story about the Egan administration was the governor was involved in rationing paper clips in order to, you know, reduce expenses. We needed cash up front, and so we did a lease system where we got a lease bonus, the $900 million we got up front, and then we got free cash from the royalty provisions once production started. We needed the cash up front. And the Norwegians say, you know, we needed the cash up front in the early stages, and we understand that governments just starting into this industry need cash up front, but we quickly figured out that distorted investment, and what was going to happen was the cash was going to go down because companies were going to go other places. And so we sort of view that one person used it, and he didn't mean it in the pejorative sense that some people take it in. He said, but we sort of viewed leasing as the juvenile system. It's what you used during your learning years before you graduated into the mature system of co-investing and developing your own resources. So they have avoided the distorting producer decisions by requiring investment of dead capital. And the state shares in oil revenue wealth without undermining industry investment. They don't require the royalty, which, as they said, undermines investment. I thought it would be useful as a second piece to take you through how they do leasing and development, because that sort of brings the whole package together and gives you a view of why the Norwegian system is working much better in terms of attracting investment than ours. Norway awards leases or licenses, they call them licenses, based on a work plan, not cash. So when there's a new area opening up and Norway is going to offer it to industry and then reserve a portion for itself, what it asks industry to bid on is a work plan. They don't want cash up front. They don't need the cash anymore, the royalty, the bonus anymore. They want to know what your work plan is, and they want you to bid on your work plan. So the leases, when the lessees and the licenses bid, they bid up front on work. And the award is based on early investment. The award is based on the industry, on the amount that of commitment that industry is willing to make in terms of early work. That gets them, under our lease bonus system, what happens is a producer pays a lease bonus and then he can sit on it for 6 years, 7 years. Or longer if certain circumstances apply. In the Norwegian system, they don't pay the lease bonus, they don't pay that option payment up front. They bid on work, and from day one, they're committed to go forward and to work on the lease. So the award's based on early investment by the producers and the performance of work. The lease and license is returned back to the state if the producer is not prepared to go to development after the initial work is completed. The initial period is 6 years, And if the producer has, at the end of that period, is not ready to go forward with the next stage of development, then the lease and license is returned to the state. Okay, so this is a quick rundown. Norway selects the tracks to license with a 6-year initial term after consultation with stakeholders. On the map that Ira showed you at the beginning, there was the North Sea in the south. You'll recall the Barents Sea in the north and the Norwegian Sea in the middle. The Norwegian Sea has largely not been developed because in consultation with stakeholders, it's been determined that that's an important fishing area, and they don't want to develop that for oil and gas resources. They don't want the conflict with fishing areas, so that has not been licensed. And so the determination of what areas to work is done in consultation with stakeholders. Norway then conducts an initial 2D seismic, which is sort of basic seismic over the area that they're going to lease. The results are made public. So all of the potential licensees have sort of the same basic information. Potential licensee can go out and acquire more information if it wants, but they all sort of have the same basic starting point. There isn't any advantage given based upon data. The industry submits applications consisting of a work plan, financial strength, safety record. There's no bonus required. It's all in the work plan. And the licenses are awarded based upon the work plan and qualifications. And the licensee has 6 years to go forward with the work plan that they've indicated in a staged. I mean, the work plan says in the first year you shall do X, and the second year you shall do Y, and the third year you shall do Z, and so forth. And if they don't perform it, they're not only in breach of contract, but the license is terminated immediately. But at the end of the 6 years, they either are then prepared to go forward with a more detailed work plan and development plan, or else the license is given back. One of the reasons Ella, I think, very, very did a great job pointing out the difference in the environmental permitting approach in Norway. All of that work is done up front at the time the license is granted. In the U.S., we have this sequence you go through. You get a license, then you got to go through an environmental review in order to drill an exploratory well, well, actually to do seismic. Then you got to go through another environmental review to go through it to drill an exploratory well. Then you got to go through another environmental review in order to drill the development wells and then to build the infrastructure around production. In Norway, all of that is reviewed up front. The work plan incorporates that. And once you get a license, there are very small environmental reviews, incremental environmental reviews that are required from that point forward. And the license may include several partners. Let's say that BP bids on an area, and there's also an indication of interest from others, but they don't have the same good work plan. But the government says, okay, BP, you've got certain expertise in this area that we like, but Statoil, you've also got expertise in this area that we like, and Shell, you've got expertise in this area that we're going to license that we like. And the government brings together a consortium, offers the opportunity to bring together a consortium that brings the best of thinking with respect to the project, and then specifies the state percentage, the pastoral percentage that we'll share as part of the terms of granting the license. Going forward, all partners are part of including the government, including Petoro, are part of the decision-making process, shared investment expenses, and they share in the information, and the government is inside the room helping to make the decisions, sometimes driving the decisions. There are instances where Petoro has brought forward inside the working interest room, has brought forward an idea of how to develop a resource that none of the private companies were coming up with, and then frankly that makes some sense because Petoro is focused on Norway exclusively. And they're always looking around the Norwegian resources about additional development. So Norway has helped the government, not by backseat driving and trying to whip people into shape, but through willing to put their own money on the line in the investment room, have helped drive the development of Norwegian resources. That's the sum and substance, but believe me, there is a reason why the production curve in Norway is higher than in the U.S. or than in Alaska, and there is a reason why the investment curve is higher in Norway than there is in Alaska, and we should learn from it. Thank you.
We're going to do a question and answer in just a moment, but first, this word from Garrett Wong.
Thank you, Ira. And thank you to the panelists for this great presentation on your trip to Norway and some insight on how we as Alaskans can maybe take some guidance from a group of people in a country that's done so well for themselves. So, food for thought. All right, you have to give me a break here. I'm having to put my reading glasses on. Hopefully I've got the right ones, but all right, First off, on your tables, you'll see membership and survey cards, and we'd appreciate your recognition of what the speakers have said today to help us develop future programs that are going to be meaningful. And of course, this is a membership-driven organization. And if you like the perspectives that were shared with you today to help you in your thinking and how it's influenced maybe how the state's going to move forward, then we'd like to encourage you to join the Alaska World Affairs Council with your membership support. It's a big $60 investment, but it's well worth it so that we can continue bringing programs like this to you. Now, Lisa, in her haste, forgot, although she was doing it in Norwegian, forgot about the Bread Basket Award. So, Carrie, I know, has got a basket full of tickets, or you do. And so I'm going to pick this, and hopefully I can read the thing. All right, the winning number is 584-109. Raise your hand if you got the ticket. 584-109. All right, the winner's
one off.
Oh, close enough, but not it.
So who's got it?
No? Oh, right here. Okay, congratulations. And of course, we don't want to forget our sponsors. In this particular case, Statoil was very generous in helping us underwrite today's presentation. So thank you, Statoil. And we do want to remind you that we do have a program next week with Larry Pursley, who will be talking about Alaska gas and where we're going to go with that. So join us downstairs next week, Friday, and I think you'll be very interested to hear where our Alaska gas might be going. And let's see, what else do we have here? I think I've got all the main points covered. So with that, I'm going to hand the podium back to Mr. Ira here. And I'd like you to, if you do have questions, wait for you to take the microphone because we are recording this for rebroadcast. So with that, thank you all for attending. We'll see you next week.
Thank you, Garrett. We have run a little long, but we have plenty of time for questions. I know our panel up here will stay as long as you'd like to ask questions. We pass the microphone around, so raise your hands and the microphone will come and I will direct the question to our panel members.
Are there any instances where the Norwegians underwrite more than 20% of the cost of a drilling operation?
That's for Brad.
Yeah. Is that on now?
You might need it closer.
If I do that, I think I'm going to pull the coffee over.
Yes,
the 20% is an average. They said that fields that have high prospectivity and they feel highly confident about, they'll take a higher percentage on licensing. And fields that have significant exploration risk, they'll take a lower percentage, but the average is around 20.
Ira?
Yes, Walt. Walt
Parker, you pointed out that the average Norway is 88,000 and it's 44,000 in the United States. And in the United States, of course, the top 1% gets 28% of the national income. Do you have a similar situation? Did you find a similar situation in Norway?
That was something we didn't specifically look at, but I think some of us developed a sense of that. Maybe I'll direct this to Ella, who has some perspective of this through Statoil.
I don't have exact numbers. I can tell you that the salaries in Norway are much more stabilized, and that's why things are so expensive. For example, the cab ride from the airport to the hotel was over $200 US. And the glass of wine that, you know, $20, I mean, there was a reason for that. Of course, high taxes as well, sales tax as well as personal taxes, between 35% to 50%, and that's part of why their permanent fund is so much higher, because they, as Rebecca mentioned, they don't spend it. They reinvest, I believe, about 4%, but everything else goes into that permanent fund for the future. But I could get you numbers, for example, the oil industry. I can tell you that our own CEO, for example, is not paid anything like the other oil companies.
This question has been bothering me ever since I've read about it in the newspaper, that the leases go based on work plan or most qualified, best able to do the work. And it makes me wonder, are there lobbyists in Norway? I can imagine, is there, or are they playing such a, as a dominant a role as we perceive here?
Brad, do you want to start with that one?
Well, I'm sure there are lobbyists. There are lobbyists everywhere. But I don't quite know what you meant by the question, but I will say that, that I was impressed. I've been a lot of places. I was impressed by the professionalism of the regulators in Norway, the people who regulate the oil and gas industry and the people who make the licensing decisions and put together the consortiums. I did not get any sense that that was affected by any sort of lobbying as we know it in the U.S. It was a much, very, a highly professional organization.
Well, I just wanted to point out that one of the significant facts that, that we learned that when we were there is that Statoil actually has, is it 60 or 80% of the current, holds 80% of the current leases. So, I mean, there,
it's pretty high.
One company has a significant portion of the leases there.
I think that what you're asking, in a sense, and we've had this question before, is how do they keep corruption out of the system? And it has to do with where the decision is made. The decision is made not by the minister, which is the same like as a commissioner here. It's made a couple of levels down. The minister and the deputy minister are appointed, political appointed positions that are appointed by the dominant political party. Immediately beneath them is a layer of lifer. We call them bureaucrats derogatorily. They don't have that derogatory position over there. But people who are in those jobs for life and cannot be removed for political on a political basis. They're there. They can take a risky decision. So they have a very well spelled out set of criteria by which they make the decision. They also use committees. They've learned how to do committees, but it is removed from the political appointee level, and that helps keep the corruption out of it.
And I would also think that the predictability of the system has an element of that too. You know that they're working in a system that's been in place for a long time that they're all familiar with that doesn't change. The rules don't change.
I understand the personal income tax is quite high in Norway. What is it equivalent to in terms of the United States and how many people? And the other thing would be, what do they do with their permanent fund?
Want to take a stab? I can take a stab at this.
Well, they don't do anything with their permanent fund. I mean, I think they save it. They're saving it for it's their rainy day fund. So when we were at the parliament that you know they indicated that they have kind of a POMV system there, where each year when they put together the national budget, they can take but don't always take up to 4% of the value of that fund to apply to the national budget, and they had never used more than $10 billion at any given time for that, and they don't do that every year. So they don't do anything with their permanent fund. They put every penny into that. It's called the National Pension Fund, but it doesn't have anything to do with pensions and doesn't pay pensions. It was just a PR move to name it that. So they don't do anything with it. And so they have a lot of taxes in that country.
There's the discussion, yes, they have a lot of taxes, and of course that allows them to continue to pay for their expenses.
Yeah.
And people ask the question typically, well, what are some of those wonderful social benefits that are offered in Norway? And what they are, cradle-to-grave health care.
Yep.
You have also education from pre-kindergarten through PhD, if you want to pursue a PhD. And if you are accepted into a college in a foreign country, so you get accepted into Stanford in the United States, the Norwegian government will pay for that. They also have a retirement system that you actually can live on. It pays you enough to live on. So I thought this through, and I remember this in my life. There's four things that cost a lot of money for me. One, saving for my kids' college. Two, my health insurance cost. Three, setting aside money for retirement. And the fourth is owning my house. Well, in Norway, three out of four of those things are paid for by your taxes. So that's why their taxes are as high as they are. That's their system. They call it the social democratic system. That's how they do it.
They did a big housing subsidy.
We didn't learn everything over there. we were truly amazed. We had a fire hose of a week trying to gather all this information. But thank you, Walt. There's a ton we didn't learn. More questions.
Yeah, I'm Charmin Haley from ICER, and thank you very much for doing this tour and bringing back such valuable insights. It's very fertile for our thinking and discussion. There's a couple points you made points that I would like to point out some other differences that you didn't elaborate on. The 8 months to permitting in Norway versus the 32 months here in Alaska. An additional reason why it's faster in Norway, like in the Barents Sea, is because they spent 10 years working on the Beaufort Management Plan, where all development was off the table until they had finished all their environmental and political debates over what their priorities were and management priorities for that area. So the political debates over environment versus development had all been done before they went to leasing and permitting instead of after.
That is true. When the Norwegian government decides it wants to open up a major area for licensing, it has this stakeholder engagement process that brings together your environmentalists, your fishermen, your coastal communities, the oil companies, the government themselves, and they sit around a table and they work these things out, and it can take years. But once they have cobbled together that agreement, which with all the stipulations and all the restrictions on it, they take that agreement to Parliament. And when Parliament passes that agreement, that's it. Lawsuits are done. The litigation doesn't happen anymore, and it moves forward.
And I think that's the point to be made, even just what the woman just said back there. Their political debate is done. Gosh, could we ever imagine our political debate being done here? We all pray for that, you know. So, and like I already said, so once it's done, and that's one thing that we really asked a lot of people about, because we were really trying to get a sense of that. You know, it appears that, you know, when we're at Snøhvit, that you start in 2007 to build, and you're in production in 2011. You know, which I mean, that's incredible. And when you see that facility, you realize how incredible that is. You know, and really asking them about that. You know, well, did you know, were there fishermen who, you know, protested this? You know, how did things work like that? And it really is true, truly done ahead of time, and there is finality to it. It's dealt with ahead of time. All of the stakeholders are brought in, and it's done. And when it's done, it's done. We don't have that here.
Well, and I think someone referred to the difference in our... We have three levels of government involved in this stuff, mm-hmm. and they have apparently one. And so the rules are different if it's on state land versus federal land. I'm curious, probably what we can affect, we Alaskans, is what happens on state, under state jurisdiction. And I'm curious as to whether there were any decision makers from the administration other than, including the political appointee level, but also the lifer level, because we have both of those.
Anybody want to tackle that? Rebecca?
Well, I mean, the first part about was there wasn't anybody from the administration on the trip. Hugh Short, who's supposed to be here today, who's the president of the ADA board, was there, which it was really great to have him there because of the position that he's in, and to have him looking at how they do things there. But I think I don't have an answer to that question for you as to what we can tackle, and that's what I mentioned. You know, there are things in their system that we cannot mimic. They have a national system. It's a country, and we have the federal, state, and local government. And so, you know, that's the thing that we have to be careful not to lead ourselves down the path of believing that we could mimic what they're doing in those areas because of the jurisdiction. So I think the answer is nothing.
We would love to have this presentation in front of the United States Congress. because, in fact, that is a big, significant part of our challenges here, our federal challenges. And we will try to do that. We will try to get in front of the appropriate committees.
I'll echo Charmin's appreciation for what you people are doing, and I hope you're going to be able to submit it to writing so that somewhere we can get a pamphlet or something that we can go over in detail. One of the things I'm struck with from your presentation, Ira, I think, of the profound cultural differences between the Norway and here. I mean, here when the oil came in, they put every dime of it into a permanent fund. When here in this country, as soon as we had a little smell of oil, we repealed the income tax. They never repealed any taxes. Doesn't that mean that when it comes to applying any of these lessons from Norway, the first issue is, well, given these cultural differences, could we actually handle it the way they do?
Who would like to tackle that on the panel?
Well, I'd love to see the person who's going to stand up and say, hey, we need a state income tax, and we're going to start putting every dime we get. Instead of taking 92% of our oil revenue next year and putting it in our operating budget, we're going to save it. You know, I mean, that's very true. I mean, those are the messages. They, even when they got all that wealth from the oil, they still maintained their very high personal income tax rate.
Brad?
From the standpoint, did I turn that on? But from the standpoint of state investment, co-investment alongside industry, I think it takes something. There's a piece of that that's very important. Norway is not the only government that has state co-investment. Venezuela, for example, has state co-investment, but Venezuela's destroyed their environment by politicizing the investment agency and allowing it to be controlled not only by the whims of the of whatever you call Chavez these days, but also the, even before that, the legislature. Norway separated it off. Probably the best analogy that we have in Alaska is the Permanent Fund Board. Separated it off in a way that it is as isolated from political process as you possibly can get. And that's something that we, if we went down this track, that we would need to do. In order to make sure that the investments are made on a professional basis and on the basis of the oil in the ground as opposed to some sort of political process. I think we're capable of it, John, but it would take a conscious effort to make sure that we didn't politicize the process.
And I guess I'd like to add to that. Yes, there's significant differences in the way Norway approaches and call it cultural, but the one thing we do have in common, you know, the first Norway's often referred to as a socialist country. Now, coming back from there, I'm not so sure that's the case. Certainly, they have great social democratic programs, but when it comes to understanding how you attract investment capital, they are uber-capitalists. They understand capitalism. And in that sense, so does this country, so does all Alaskans. We have that piece of language in common, and that's the co-investment idea. You know, if you take a risk and you invest, take a risk, you get rewards. We understand that as a people. So I think that transcends that cultural issue.
That was one of the interesting points, just kind of flippant comments made by the woman from the Ministry of Tax that we met with when they were talking about they used to have a royalty. And somebody said, well, why don't you have the royalty anymore? And she said, because industry came to us and told us that would deter investment, so we don't have it anymore.
Next question.
Just a couple of historic facts. The woman made a point about Alaska and the state and the federal, I think, is important. What we have in our leasing program is an EIS statement and a massive amount of review. We just have multi-layers of it. And to think that, for example, that we need a new coastal zone management plan to expedite that would be the wrong viewpoint, I think. And also, I'm reminded of my cousin, because I'm a Norwegian Alaskan, is that I do believe that they are a socialist country, and you can ask my cousin, the Norwegian Lutheran minister, who's paid by the Norwegian government.
Thank you, Norm. Thank you.
Just a quick question. You briefly touched on the LNG work at the top of the country. Is there any detail you can add as to where they're at with that and where they're going with it?
Ella.
I would comment that the majority of their natural gas is exported to other markets, and their own electricity and power comes from hydroelectric. Yeah. I didn't actually get to go on that part of the tour because I left early, so I don't know if you guys have anything to add.
I would say that originally that LNG plant was designed to bring LNG to the U.S., but as a result of shale, just like Alaska gas is no longer economic in the lower 48, neither is imported LNG. So they're rerouting. They're going through a thought process about how to do it, but they've already sent at least one ship, and I noticed the other day they've licensed 9 more to go over the top of Russia to bring it into the Asian market. And they're now viewing that LNG project, and there are two other projects in northern Russia along the Arctic that are similar. They're now viewing those as Asian export markets. So a byproduct. When we think about the Asian market, and that's our natural market, the competition is coming from other Arctic countries and is going to come over the top. There's going to be a lot more LNG going into Asia than there is right now.
And it was fascinating to think about that it is economic to send LNG from Norway all the way over the top of Russia through the Bering Strait onto Asia. And as they go through the Bering Strait, they say, look, we can see Alaska from here.
And that one of the more interesting parts of our trip when we were in Hammerfest, we were on the bus leaving the LNG facility, and they had an enormous amount of construction work going on. They were tearing up the streets, and everybody said, we had just had a presentation from the Hammerfest mayor about everything that town had done to welcome Statoil there with the facility, because they really wanted them there because of what it meant for them economically. And so we said to the bus driver, what are they doing here? Heated streets. All the streets they were going to have heated streets.
No more snow plowing.
No more snow plowing, yeah. So that's what LNG meant for them.
Another question in the back of the room, please.
Yeah, as an Alaskan, I was happy to see the price of a barrel of oil go, say, from $16 to $35 a barrel up to $100 a barrel, which is where we're probably selling it now. I don't know what the price is exactly, but I suspect that in another 10 years it may be $200, $300 a barrel. And why would we Alaskans say, hey, let's use all ours up right now? And even as an American, you know, I know our percentage of the world's proven resources has supposedly gone from 5% to 2% since about 1975. So anyone comment on that?
If I can figure out which way to hit this. I'll do that one. There's a great story about a coal reserve in England that the English government kept off limits for years and years and years because they thought the price of coal was always going to go up and that they would use that coal reserve someday to just cash in and become zillionaires over there. Well, of course, the price of coal collapsed and the coal reserve that they kept off limits and reserved never has been developed. We always think that our resources are going to always be valuable, but you never know. And the best course, in my experience, the best course is to cash in while you can, as long as it's economic and it makes a good profit, to cash in what you can, because you never know what tomorrow's going to bring.
How are we doing on time? Fine. Okay, good.
Just a point of information. There is an excellent article written by Martin Sandbu, entitled The Iraqi Who Saved Norway from Oil, in the Financial Times magazine of London. And his name is Farouk El-Kassim, and he was hired in the early days when Norway was just thinking about getting oil, and they weren't going to continue drilling because it had been unsuccessful. But the principle that he put in place was that they would drill for the last drop, and apparently average extraction rate worldwide is about 25%, and Norway averages 45%. And that principle has also forced them to increase their expertise, which of course now they're reselling. But I would highly recommend the 2009 article, The Iraqi Who Saved Norway from Oil.
It is a wonderful story of serendipity. Another interesting story is about Norway's permanent fund. Norway's oil revenue came on a little slower than ours. They didn't hit the big giant Prudhoe Bay. They started with a series of smaller fields. But by the mid-80s, they knew they were coming into a gusher of revenue, and they didn't know quite what to do with it. So they looked around the world and said, who's got a good plan for what to do with excess revenue? And lo and behold, if they didn't spot Alaska and our permanent fund. And so they sent a delegation from Norway to Juneau to meet with our permanent fund corporation in the mid-1980s. Coming from that, they developed their version of a permanent fund, which obviously got some differences, but they learned from us, and they learned how to do it better than us.
I had a Statoil question on
Does Statoil have investments in the Iranian oil fields?
I don't believe we have investments in Iran. We do have investments in Iraq. And I don't have all the details. I'm pretty focused on Alaska, but if you went to our statoil.com is our main website, you could probably look into that. You know, jurisdiction decisions are partly based on the risk of investing in those countries, and some places are a lot more risky than others in terms of the political situation.
Again, I want to thank our panelists for their wonderful insight, and we'll welcome you again next week to our Larry Pursley meeting. So we'll see you next Friday.
Thank you.